This is an ABC podcast.
Warning, this podcast contains strong language.
Are you really still here, Steve?
Jude, you're one of my oldest friends. I love you.
I love you too, Steve.
Shall we hug?
No. But can you give us one final recap?
No, Jude. I love you, but honestly, if people don't know what the show's about, it's either because they don't like you or they just don't give a fuck.
Hello, I'm Judith Lucy and I'm overwhelmed and dying. Just before turning 50, I realised that I was totally overwhelmed by the state of the world and my own life. But I also felt like time was running out. So the question is, how to make the most of the years that I have left on this planet? What gives your life meaning?
My kids, all the time, I am grateful for what I have today.
Really creating a better planet, not just for human beings, but for all the microbes, bacteria, the plants, the animals, and the human beings.
What would you say is currently giving your life meaning?
Putting one foot after the other?
That might be the most honest response I have received to that so far. So well done. Last week, when we looked at meaning, the wonderful Stephen Oliver talked about...
Mother Earth is the ultimate church.
I think that's been one of the themes of this crazy little podcast, along with people coming together to take action. So that's what we're looking at in this final episode, tying all this crap together. For a lot of us, and I'm quoting a line I got from simply typing the word meaning into Google, so obviously it's true. Meaning is about being part of something that we really believe in that is bigger than ourselves. I've only experienced this a couple of times in my life, being part of an ancient Hindu ritual on the Ganges, camping in the centre of Australia while also spending time with some female Aboriginal elders, and attending a Fleetwood Mac concert. So it might have had less to do with the sacred and more to do with a real concern that Stevie Nicks could drop dead halfway through singing Gypsy. Anyway, I'd also been blown away by visiting Uluru, Kakadu Park and the Great Barrier Reef. This country might not have stuff like the Colosseum, but I believe that what we do have is a lot more precious. Somewhere I hadn't been was Ningaloo Reef in WA. I have to be honest too, my Great Barrier Reef experience was not ideal. I'm not a strong swimmer, as we know, so when we went on a snorkeling tour, I asked my partner to keep an eye on me once we got in the water. He forgot that and completely disappeared about 3 seconds after we landed in the ocean. The very lovely captain gave me one of those foam noodles, which wasn't humiliating at all for a woman in her 30s. Why hadn't I brought my floaties? He urged me to put my head underwater, a fairly essential part of snorkeling. I panicked, got the most blinding headache immediately, and had to get back on the boat where I started vomiting and didn't stop for hours. The only upside was when the captain said, "Actually, fish love vomit, so while you're throwing up, you'll probably see some really beautiful marine life." The next day, I had to go to a doctor who surprisingly asked me to remove my bra. His theory was that I'd either put my neck out or that I should go to emergency because there was a chance that I was going to have a stroke. We were leaving the next day, so I decided to do the responsible thing and get through the next 24 hours by mixing mango daiquiris and Mercendal Fort. It worked! Drink responsibly. I figured I needed to try the whole reef thing again, though. And I also wanted to go to Ningaloo because I knew not only that it's one of the few healthy reefs left in the world, but because it had been saved and ultimately heritage listed because of a grassroots campaign nearly 20 years ago. I had also read that swimming with the humpback whales and whale sharks that can be found there was a life-changing experience. Thanks to my childhood, though, I have pretty mixed feelings about my home state, Western Australia. It sounds awful. I didn't really want to go back. But I did, and I decided that my first stop should finally be visiting the cemetery where my parents' ashes are buried. My brother's death had been a big part of feeling overwhelmed. Have you been listening? I think I've made that very clear. So I genuinely wondered how dropping in on Mum and Dad would affect me. You know what I like to do on a Saturday afternoon when I'm in my hometown of Perth? I like to go to Karrakatta Cemetery. This is where Mum and Dad are buried. Well, they're not, because they were cremated. But look, we're here because despite the fact that Mum and Dad died 19, 20 years ago, respectively, I have never, ever visited where their ashes are buried. I've never looked at the plaques, but people have said to me, no, you'll be surprised, you should go. It's like you'll find it quite moving, you'll pause, you'll remember them. I've got to admit to you, I'm pretty skeptical, but let's find out. A raven, how appropriate. We are now wandering down the main driveway. I have no sense of direction, so what should take several minutes could take a good hour or two, but fingers crossed. And of course, they're buried in the Roman Catholic area. I forgot that they do kooky things like that in cemeteries. Let's keep everyone segregated even when they're dead. What a good approach. Oh, Anglican, fuck off. I don't think so. Playing for the reserves. Catholic or nothing, thank you. I'm starting to feel we may have gotten a little lost, but let's keep going. I'm never sure about the photo on the tombstone, like there's one for John William there. He's smiling, and my guess is he doesn't look like that now. Who knows where the fuck we are? They need buggies. Mum! Dad! Jesus, it's my childhood all over again. We have just spent 2 hours wandering around this mind fuck of a cemetery and we couldn't find them. I am now starting to think that they faked their own deaths. Maybe they're living in Spain. In some ways, I think I am more emotional not finding them than I actually would have been finding them. And now I kind of am really sad. RIP, Mum and Dad. All I can say is I'll give it another crack next time I'm in town. Or hope you're happy wherever you are. That went well. Bummer. That was meant to be an intense and moving moment to add some heft to the final episode. Lucky I still had Ningaloo Reef to go to. Would I feel part of something bigger, though? I mean, I was sure it was going to be pretty, but part of me wondered if I'd get more from going to a bar. Someone who'd written about the reef and had been involved in the original campaign to save it was an author you might have heard of, Tim Winton. Full disclosure, I'm a bit obsessed with Mr. Winton. I love his writing, partly because it taps into something almost holy about our landscape. I'm not saying that one of the reasons I picked Ningaloo Reef was because I thought he might talk to us about it, but it was. Here we are trying to avoid the wind and tourists as Tim takes my producer Carla and I around the canyons of Exmouth.
Yeah. Pink line.
Yeah.
That's
right.
The Pilbara.
Oh, wow.
Where are we, Tim?
We're at the top of the Cape Range, looking down a big dry canyon, looking over the Exmouth Gulf, and behind us, the glorious expanse of the Ningaloo Reef.
Can you tell us about the first time you went there?
I got taken out in a boat by a friend of a friend, and I thought we were going fishing, and the skipper said, get your fins on, get in the water. I didn't quite know what to expect, and because it was so deep, I mean, the water was purple and it was all silver spinning plankton-like sequins all in the water. It was very beautiful and slightly discombobulating, you know. And then out of this purple gloom came this enormous spotted creature, like a moving dot painting. It was a whale shark, and it just short of 10 metres. So it was just an incredible experience of having this thing swim past me and that's a life-changing experience. I want to do it again now, you know, and forever. That childlike wonder that you get just being face-to-face with a marvel of nature is a great privilege. And look, not everybody can have that experience, but I think it's important. Most of us hear about wild places full of wonder and marvels. I think we all need to know that these places still exist because it gives us hope for the future. You know, if we're living in a world that's still alive, I mean, if we still have ecosystems that are still intact and wild, then that's potential. When despair creeps in, it's when you can feel a loss of agency, that word, you know. We have to give some kind of shape to our rage and to fight off despair, to refuse despair. And, you know, when you realise that you are essentially cosmic dandruff, which is to say stardust, you can either feel flat about that and just think that puts me in my place. But there's something kind of gorgeous about that, to know that we're all made of the same thing. You know, we're carbon life forms. There's something holy about that. And that reminds me of a little quote from one of the world's great nudists, William Blake: all that lives is holy. At my angriest, at my most despairing, when I bubble up with the poison that I feel about certain people and certain corporations and certain situations, I have to come back to that. All that lives is holy. One of the miraculous things about life is that we're not worse than we are. When we have the immense capacity to do evil.
Can you tell us a bit about the original campaign to save Ningaloo?
Nearly 20 years ago now.
I can't honestly say I got dragged into it, but I was reluctant.
And not optimistic.
No, I thought we were cactus. But I just thought that we had to have a go, and there were six of us at the time looking at each other as, you know, well, what are we going to do? And in the end, the thing that we knew that we couldn't do was nothing, because that just made the result that we thought was likely inevitable. It was just so chock full of marvels and wonders, you know, and we just thought, oh, we've got to save this place. So, yeah, it was telling the story, I guess, of this unknown place and introducing it to Australia and to the world. And my job really has always been to try and bring different kinds of people together. So we'd go to these meetings and, you know, there'd be people with facial piercings and wacky coloured hair, and there'd be people with pearl and twin set. And so when the Audis are parked next to the combis, you know you're half a chance. But something happened, I think. We accidentally stumbled onto some little vein of hope. We found something that was sacred to people. And in the end, there were about 100,000 people who got involved over those years. So it was a great experience.
How inspiring, though, to see a bunch of people that disparate put their differences to one side and just all come together for the common good. Like, did you have a moment of going, wow, people are capable of this?
Yeah, I think I had lots of moments during the campaign, and then when we got the decision, when Jeff Gallop, who was the Premier at the time, bless his heart, when they decided they were going to listen to the people and they were going to make sure that no crazy development was going to happen on the Ningaloo coast, I actually couldn't believe it. What people can do when they get organised, when they get clean information, when they cooperate, when they get discipline, and I think that's important. Students walking out of school and striking, I think it's encouraged to see people rebelling, because I still think it's the most logical thing to do, given that our elders and betters are not acting in our common interest. But what they'll learn is that the most effective and long-lasting form of action is organised and collective, and then I've seen it work, and I've made lifelong friendships from being at the barricades, so to speak, with people I didn't know otherwise.
The fight is not over. So can you tell us where we're at now and how oil and gas interests are threatening the reef again?
The price of victory is eternal vigilance. Frankly, if it wasn't for a couple of volunteers in a tiny local community organisation here in Exmouth, we wouldn't have known that there were plans afoot to build a gas and oil pipeline launching facility deep in the bottom of Exmouth Gulf, which is Ningaloo's nursery. My heart sank so far, I just thought, I can't believe we have to fight this again. If Subsea 7 get to build their gas pipeline launch facility, which means launching 10-kilometre-length gas pipelines from a pristine beach down at the bottom of the Gulf, dragging these juggernauts, enormous tugs at each end, with about 500 really heavy chains as thick as your arm,
Can you give us an idea of how catastrophic it would be?
Well, I mean, the company's been trying not to let on for nearly 2 years now, but they've finally admitted that at least 1,800 hectares of seabed will be disturbed or destroyed as a result. So that's sponges, corals, all the soft bottom communities that create so much of the life here. It's really like several maritime disasters. Each of those towheads at the beginning and ending of the pipeline weighs about the same as a trawler. So it's like dragging a trawler across the bottom. That's just the beginning. If Subsea 7 gets to build their pipeline facility in Exmouth Gulf, then that just unlocks the door to a larger industrialisation of Exmouth Gulf by the oil and gas industry. The Gulf has twice as much biodiversity as the reef, twice as many fish species, for instance. So it's teeming with life, and it's what helps regenerate the life of Ningaloo Reef. The two places are deeply interconnected. It comes down to the weight of numbers. Politicians, they respect people, they represent people, they just fear numbers. And I think we have to encourage them to do the right thing and make them very afraid of doing the wrong thing. And I think, frankly, it's just a matter of people getting informed, talking to each other, and it's about legacy. This is about climate as well. One of the things that bothers me is, how do we live a moral life? How do you become a good ancestor? How do you live a life that will be honoured by people who will never meet you? You would have left something behind that's better, not worse. And I'm anxious about being part of a generation that would leave less behind than it inherited itself. And I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be part of that cohort. Things are probably worse than they were when we were fighting the original campaign. And in the intervening years, I think despair has been stalking people. I start to get irritated by that because that's kind of lazy. It's giving yourself a note from your mum to leave you out. Don't bother me. I don't have to do anything. I've already decided that it's pointless. You only find out if you're going to win by having a crack, you know? And my experience is that you don't always win, but you only ever win by having a crack. Cheap despair is just lazy and mediocre.
And to people who are listening to this, is it like find the community that's going to fight for the stuff you want to save and just get involved?
Yes, I think so. You can spend a lot of time scratching your chin and intellectualising about all of this. And that's something that you do when there's acres of time. We know we don't have time. If we don't change from how we generate our power extremely quickly, then all the coral reefs in the world are gone. I think that's not even a contentious argument anymore. That's the consensus. You search out the stories that are appealing to you. You search out the things that are important to you. You look for the people who are taking action and who seem authentic, and you test it. All movements are full of flakes and false messiahs.
One thing I am astonished by is the fact that we don't seem to be listening to our Aboriginal peoples when it comes to looking after this land.
I think that's that old settler contempt for the Indigenous. Mainstream Australians are slowly learning what sacredness of country is, and it's a kind of a disgrace that we're taking so long to catch up. You know, understanding our country and understanding its history and its prospects, these are all the same question. Defending country, understanding country, earning your belonging. These are all vital projects that we should be spending more time on and perhaps less time on shopping.
Well, let's see what happened when I went out with Tim and orca specialist John Totterdell. I mean, sure, I like nature. I'm not a cyborg. I'd hung out with a tree in a past episode and had also decided to become involved with a community-based movement called Climate for Change. But would popping on some flippers and another possible chunder fest tie all this crap together?
We're just cruising on the outside of Ningaloo Reef. We're heading south. And we're looking for some northbound humpback whales that are coming up along the reef edge. That's what we're looking for. Looking for a blow or a black back that when they come up and surface. So there's a couple just out wide of us, but we're going to try and find some close to the reef.
Yep. That's our manta, is it?
Yeah, it's manta. Oh. We've got a heap more ahead as well.
There's plenty ahead.
We're seeing manta rays, aren't we? Yes. Jesus. So close.
Another manta. We've just seen a group of 10 or 12 mantas, and there's a few more here. The mantas also swim and forage in behind the reef where a lot of food is found.
Hey, wow.
So mobile. Two big wings with white tips, and as they lift their wings up, black wings from the top, they show their whites. You can swim with them 100 times, and the last time is as good as the first. Sometimes they interact, they'll barrel roll with you in the water. They often do that in what they call a chain, three, four, five mantas. We head to tail in a spiral. They're good fun. Yeah, there's someone home.
Okay, we are really traveling at the moment. So like we've just seen three. Oh wow. We are very close to three humpback whales. Jumping out of the water. They are big motherfuckers. Then John the skipper stopped the boat and said, "Get in the water now." I put on my snorkel and flippers and jumped in.
Head in the water, head down in the water.
I had no idea what I was doing, but mercifully had no time to think about it. A bit like the time I had Botox injected into my G-spot, but that's a story for another time. Look, I was kind of blown away enough by just... Well, let's start off with the fact that I can't really swim. And then go... But I did wind up snorkeling with mantas, so that was just mind-blowing enough. Then after that, just seeing so many whales up that close was just incredible. And then just when I thought my mind couldn't get any more blown, we got back into the water and we were, I don't know, Tim, how many meters above?
About 8 meters
above an enormous mother humpback whale and her calf. And I really, when we got back on the boat, sat down and I actually thought I was going to cry. I really did. Like, that's talking about that idea of really something affecting you in a way where something sinks in and you go, I am so tiny and I am a part of something that is so much bigger, and I'm actually still feeling incredibly emotional. So it was extraordinary.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I certainly did. And it doesn't matter how many times you do it, your heart just feels like it's going to explode.
Yeah.
And all your emotions just run wild and you just feel charged up. I just feel like I've just experienced something holy. And I just feel enormously privileged to be there to see it. And to see these creatures that are just so many times bigger than us, and even the baby just cleaving to the back of her mum, just surfing the slipstream of her mother's momentum, you know, just watching them move. And they didn't even actually look like they were moving in the water. They just passed us at about 3 knots. And there was a tiny bit of tail movement, and then they go past us, and you think, oh my God, look at that. And we'd been any closer, they would have been so big that it might have been a little harder to cope, because that blows your mind when you just get a little bit scared, you know?
And John, our wonderful skipper here, was just pointing down to... Put your face in, and I just didn't even realise what I was saying. And then suddenly the realisation hit me, and I had, I think, maybe 30 glorious seconds of realising what was going on before I think I'd just lost my mind, stopped breathing properly, and maybe started drowning a little bit, which is when I... to put my head back up. But I am kind of lost for words.
That's the wild world, you know? That's what wildness is. It just T-bones you. It just takes you by surprise. It's just more than you can process. And the great thing is there are parts of the world that are still live and wild and just going to blow your mind just because of the possibility, the potential, the largeness. So you get in the water and you think, oh, that's what I am. Cosmic dandruff.
Yeah. And I don't use this phrase very often, but I feel I have just had a life-changing experience. I really do. And I want to do that again.
Well, you can always delay the flight.
No one was more surprised than me by my reaction to snorkeling with a humpback whale. I have never felt so awestruck, so small, and so inspired to do something. I honestly didn't think that this podcast would have a definitive ending, but for me, it really has. And if you're doubting my sincerity, just listen to this music. This experience really did tie all the crap together, and I couldn't believe that it took returning to my home state of Western Australia to do it. I want to do everything I can to help preserve this magical place and to do what I can on climate change. This week, anyway. I also want to keep volunteering locally. That's not going to be the answer for everyone. But I do believe that the way to stop being overwhelmed is to work out what you're passionate about and what you can contribute. And talking to all the people we've met for this series has also reaffirmed for me just how important connection is, man. Epilogue. Some of you might remember that in the first episode, I said that I'd stopped listening to music. Well, I've started again. Here's a song we played at Niall's funeral. For who knows how my love goes, and who knows where the time goes. It's Sandy Denny singing Who Knows Where the Time Goes. I wasn't familiar with it, but his best friend suggested it because the song is, of course, heartbreakingly apt. His friend didn't know where the time went. Frankly, none of us did. Here I am at my brother's favourite pub again, Little Creatures in Fremantle.
Here's to you, big brother. Cheers.
I'm still single, menopausal, and my neck looks a bit like a gecko. But that sense of urgency that I talked about in the first episode is now fueled not so much by despair, but a sense of possibility, both about my life and the world. Look, don't get me wrong, heaps of stuff is still shit, and I struggle with how uncertain everything is, but I'm finding that less paralyzing. I wouldn't be dead for quids because one day I really will be dead. I'm Judith Lucy and I'm still dying. But you know what? The only thing overwhelming me now is the thought of that humpback whale.
There we go, little baby. Little he's tiny.
Wow.
Oh, he's learning how to jump.
Judith Lucy, Overwhelmed and Dying is an ABC Audio Studios production. Produced by Carla Arnold, sound design by Brendan O'Neill, voiceover by Stephen Briggs, theme music composed and performed by Gareth Skinner, executive producer Tom Wright, special thanks to Justine Kelly, Ian Walker, Kaz Cook, Andrea Powell and Jane Dullard, head of Audio Studios, Kelly Reardon. Created, written and presented by me, Judith Lucy. FYI everyone, there is no episode 9, How I Survived the Pandemic. But if you want to keep the conversation going, why not join the Overwhelmed and Dying Facebook group? My official Facebook page will have a link, so just send a request and we can all be overwhelmed together.